Hi friends, you're listening to Convos with me, Kathy Clark. Gary and I are the lead pastors at Hillsong Church in the UK. I'm so happy to have you join us in the conversation today. This program is for you, and really all we're doing is having a good, honest talk about real life stories. So whether you're on your daily commute, you're in the car, or you're at home with a coffee, sit back and I hope you enjoy today's chat. And by the way, don't forget to join the conversation on Instagram using the hashtag Convos with Kathy. Hi friends, hope you're doing well out there today. You're going to be joining us and we're going to be talking to Dr. Robbie Sonderegger. So it's the month of February and we've celebrated Valentine's Day, which for some is great fun and for others maybe not so much fun. But wherever you fall in that spectrum, we've got someone with us today and I think he'll be able to just help us all out just a little bit on the subject of relationships. So Dr. Robbie is both a strong teacher of the Bible and an accomplished clinical psychologist. He's recently been here with us at church and has done both relationship nights for single and dating people and for married people as well. So we thought we'd just dig a little bit deeper into some of what he's been talking about, as well as ask just a few questions so that we get to know Dr. Robbie a little bit better. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Great to be having a cuppa and a conversation with you.
I know. And that is it. It's a conversation.
Beautiful.
So that's what we definitely
So not therapy, just for
no,
the record. Okay,
no,
you're just saying that for the record, aren't you?
No, we've left the couch outside. No therapy today. I guess relationships is one of the big things that that you do
yes,
talk about.
It's
one of those kind of specialty areas. And it is an area that people always want to know about, isn't it?
Everyone's in a relationship one way or the other, whether it's romantic or with work colleagues or children and parents or there's always something to learn when it comes to relationships.
Yes, and that is one thing I think probably just talking to people in church that they'd love to hear about that. They love to hear about relationships. Most of us just kind of try and do our best, but it's always special to be able to hear from someone that's maybe a little bit more qualified or an expert. We're going to stick you there. We're going to say you're the expert in the field today.
Great. You go for it.
But I wanted to start
out. The love doctor is in town. All right. I get you. I get what you're saying. No, I'm with you.
But I wanted to start out with something that maybe people aren't going to expect right now. And if we're talking about relationships, I really wanted to hear maybe from you your first recollection or memories of a very, very special relationship that we would all start out on at some point in time, and that would be with Jesus.
Oh, wow. So here I'm thinking my wife, my mum, my cat, Jesus. Well, look, I grew up in church and I had a relationship with church before I had a relationship with Jesus. And I wasn't faithful to that relationship with church and kind of went my own way when I got old enough. It was a very cultish and conservative church. Grace was a foreign word. And so I kind of wandered and then one day I met this girl and she challenged me and she said, look, I don't want to spend my life with somebody who doesn't share my number one passion. And she was a Christian. She was talking about her relationship with Jesus. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I've earned my right to be called a Christian because I endured all these years of church. And because of her challenge, actually, I started reading the Bible again. And we went together to Africa and it was in Zambia, reading the Bible from literally cover to cover, well, New Testament anyway, the Message Bible at that. So simple enough for a simple guy like me to understand. And I got to Romans chapter 8. And it just hit me full force. I clearly remember sitting in the front seat of a truck driving somewhere and I put the Bible down and I said, that's it. This Jesus guy, I want in. Yeah. I want a relationship with you. This is not about religion. This is about an intimate journey that we get to walk and talk together. And the grace that's been extended to me, I'd never heard or read anything about. In fact, I got really angry. How is it possible that I could spend my entire life in church and no one has ever told me this stuff before?
Yeah. Isn't it funny how I am sure most people, dare I go as far as to say everyone, would remember exactly where they were, exactly what they were doing, when they really had some sort of encounter or eyes were opened to Jesus and who this Jesus is. And
it's a little bit like saying yes to a proposal. You remember your proposal.
Yes.
And that's what it was like for me. Jesus was proposing to enter into a relationship with me, and that's the moment I decided to say yes.
Okay, so you weren't in a like in a big church meeting or...
Nope. In a truck on the front seat with a Bible.
And there was no one preaching at you. Nope. Or great, you know, wonderful Christian Hillsong music playing in the background or anything like that?
Exactly. No, nothing like that. On a dirt track in the middle of, you know, the rural copper belt of Zambia.
Yeah.
Just me and my Bible and my Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love the fact that, I mean, many people come to meet Jesus through large meetings or crusades, yeah, or church buildings or whatever. But then I love the fact that really it comes down to, once again, we talk about relationships, but it comes back down to so often someone talking to someone.
Yes, it does.
That's just saying, you know, well, this is what I do and this is what I believe, and sharing a little bit about their life in a relationship that with Jesus.
And if it's inspirational enough, people say, I want that too.
Yeah.
I recognize I have a void in my life, and it would, yeah, be awesome to fill that void.
Okay. So we will jump into some kind of man-woman kind of relationship stuff, because that's what people like to know more about.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, I have to ask you this now. We'll just start here with, do you think it's necessary? Because I know I'm a little bit older. You are, I know you're quite a sort of traditional sort of person yourself, but is it really necessary for the guy to make the move? Or when you look at today and you look around, it's very kind of neutral, isn't it? Like
it
when
is.
You look very much at gender and those responsibilities, equality is that big, big word. And it's sort of like, well, shouldn't the girl, what about the girl inviting the guy out?
Yeah.
So where do you sit on that? How do you feel about that?
I'm really open to it, in fact. I think if a girl has such great confidence and courage and she goes after what she wants, all the power to her. But I say to the guy, if you're sitting back and passive and somebody needs to pursue you, you know, what's wrong with you? Like, get up as well and start identifying what is it that I want in my life and go after it, because that represents character. Mm-hmm. And when we have a sense of resolve and meaning and purpose, well, it gets expressed in that way. But it doesn't have to be. I don't reckon it's a traditional rule that needs to uphold and how dare a female approach or a man must or anything like that. But rather, it would be a good idea for a man to step up, because all too often men these days, it's like, where are the good men?
Yeah.
Like, there are all these passive guys hiding, you know, in their living rooms in front of their computers.
Is that the case, do you think?
I think that there's a challenge that men are confronted with these days, and that is that we're in no rush. There's no urgency for us. You know, we don't have a biological clock that's ticking, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so, like, just back off the pressure already, you know. I'm loving my Sony PlayStation for a little while longer.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's not the same for women. And so these days, I think men are not encouraged to grow up unless we're incentivized by career or money. But all too often these days, you know, well, if I'm still living at home and mum and dad are supporting me, well, I've got no incentive to go out and do that either. And so men are staying boys longer. And I think it's time we grew up.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's the same? Because we're possibly looking at two contexts here of, say, within the church and then outside the church. Do you reckon it's the same in both situations?
I talk to women around the world, single women, and the same question is posed: where are all the good men these days? And so it's hard, I guess, for a single woman to say, I want to spend my life with somebody who is going to be, you know, a spiritual leader of my home, a man of great character, a man who knows where he's going in life, a go-getter, somebody who's passionate, not just about business, but also about the things of God. And you know, I think that we as a church have a responsibility to actually encourage young men to be all that they can be and recognize that maybe we haven't done such a good job in the past, but maybe now is our time.
Mm-hmm. Do you think women are a bit scary? Do you think women have become more dominant and more pushy and more scary? That's, you know? Like,
One-on-one, I don't think women are scary. Collectively, it's very scary. In terms of the movements and the ideologies,
yes.
Look, men don't know what to do anymore. You know, it used to be that the in the traditional stereotype roles, I was the provider. But now, pay equality, you know, arguments aside, for many women, especially young single women, the statistics show that they're actually earning more than men. And so if I'm not the provider in a traditional relationship, then what's my role? What do I do and who am I? And I've kind of been given this subtle message, well, you don't need you anymore. We're quite fine on our own, thanks very much. Mm. And so I'm not needed. And then if I was to go out on a date, you know, if I was to, you know, open the door, then I'll be, you know, labeled as some kind of chauvinist and, you know, and insulting and offensive because, you know, what am I communicating, that she's disabled and unable to open the door on her own? Mm. And so I don't know what to do on a date. I don't know what to do in my, so there's a lot of questions that men have as a result of the movement, but not the woman. So one-on-one, you peel back the layers of the onion and the heart of a woman is like, no, I want a man. I want a man to look after me and cherish me and open the door and protect me.
Yeah.
And not that I need it, but I long for it.
Yeah, makes you feel special.
It makes me feel special. And so, yeah, one-on-one, no problem. Mm-hmm. As a movement, very scary.
Because I think if we just step back and look at the world now, there is a lot of women movements and, you know, the Me Too, or there's a lot of feminist type of movements that are going on. Can you name any men type movements?
Oh, they do exist, but they're very few and far between.
Well, see, I can't right now if I'm just off the cuff trying to think, is there anything that the guys just kind of stand up and...
Nah.
And rally to,
and if they like, do, they're quickly labelled as misogynistic. They're you know, marginalised and discarded as extremists in any way. And I think there's a good thing. It's a good thing that there's not too many men movements, you know, standing up for our rights, because when we do that, we actually are denoting our own insecurity. And insecurity stands on the shoulders of inferiority. So if we're having to stand up and, you know, defend our rights, well, inferiority is a direction of fear. In fear, oriety comes from orientation. The orientation of our fear is inwards. So it's birthed out of fear. Nothing good comes out of a movement birthed out of fear. So
Say that then to the women movements.
Oh, well, amen. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Because a women's liberation movement in a secular domain is all about getting freedom, the freedom that we deserve, standing up for our rights. And not that there's anything wrong with that. In fact, quite great in one sense. But if you're demanding your rights, you're at the lowest rung of the leadership ladder. But Christian women, if they truly understand who they are in Christ, don't need to demand their liberation. They recognize, I'm already been set free. I don't need to be insecure and inferior because that just presents itself as arrogance. No, I'm going to claim my authority of who I am in Christ Jesus, and that we are equal in value. I don't need to demand or fight for anything. I just need to know who I am and therefore live with confidence.
Yeah.
Now, that's beautiful. It's very attractive, by the way.
I believe it is. Exactly. It's... And then that comes back to relationship, but then that comes back to you developing and nurturing your relationship with your Heavenly Father.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what missing. That's what's missing in the world today. We've got this void, and so we're out there protesting and fighting for something that ultimately is never fulfilling.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just kind of jump now to another area. How do you think that? Because you know that's. This is something that involves a lot of younger people. How do you think that social media affects relationships these days? Can I just say, I didn't have a phone and even use social media until, well, I was 38 or 39 or something.
We're so old, aren't we?
So now I just keep having to remind myself that so many of the people that we've got in church have lived in a world that's they've known nothing different.
Yeah, the landscape has changed.
Definitely. So I have to kind of remind myself that.
Yeah.
So how do you think that social media is affecting relationships with younger younger people?
Well, social media changes our identity in one sense. It has to, by default, because what we are doing is we are putting ourselves out there on display for others to see. And so in psychology, we call this public self-consciousness, that we become very aware of what the public that we are presenting ourselves to think of us, as defined and reinforced by the number of likes that we get, the number of comments, the number of reposts or shares. And so we become a little lopsided in public self-consciousness. Now, there's nothing wrong with public self-consciousness. In fact, it's great. Scripture even says your reputation is worth its weight in gold. So it's important to take care of your reputation. But if we're only and exclusively concerned with what other people think of us, then we've got a major void in our own identity. There's only half of us. And when it comes to relationship, two halves don't make a whole. In fact, in God's economy, we were saying at a relationship seminar last night, is that, hey, it's multiplication, not addition. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 × 1 = 1. So if you're only half because you're lopsided in your identity and you find another young, you know, person who's also half, well, half times a half equals a quarter. You're worse off together than what you would be on your own.
Yeah.
So the other half of what we need to develop is called private self-consciousness, which is where I don't care so much about what other people think of me, but what I care about is what I believe in. What do I stand for? What are my core values? Yeah. This is now who I am. And when it comes to relationship, that's what we find attractive, not just how I appear on the outside. You can go to the shop and you can buy something from the supermarket. You know, you can go to the frozen section and the package is so appealing. The picture on the outside of the cardboard looks so good, but you would never come home and eat the cardboard. It's the substance on the inside that counts. So it doesn't matter how well we present ourselves. Yeah. Once you enter into a relationship, it's very, very quickly clear as to whether or not there's substance to you.
So I know that I'm not saying that within the church everything's perfect and all relationships are perfect, but it is one environment when people come, whether they come to youth or whether they're coming to church on a Sunday or other activities and social activities, but it is one place where we can get taught about those internal things that you're just talking about. So we get that half of our life sorted out as well.
And taught not just through education either, not just through preaching or teaching, but through experience, through engagement in small groups and learning and exercising and participating in these core values and generosity and serving and hospitality. And it's interesting too, because we're doing it face-to-face with other people, not just online. We're having a real relationship, interacting, because a lot of young people today, we've lost the experience of interacting face-to-face like previous generations would have. In fact, most people today, if you ask them or survey them, they say, I'd rather send a text than actually pick up the phone and call.
Oh, definitely.
Because call requires me to talk with my mouth and I'd rather talk with my thumbs.
That's true. That's very true. So I love the fact that we do have within church that ability to be able to train, help, teach, lead by example, what are those things that are core values that are really, really important to us?
Yeah.
And then managing that public persona that they also have to, because we can't wipe out social media.
No. And I think social media is a great thing. And, you know, I'm one of these advocates who, you know, goes against the grain and says, you know, when I hear people saying, oh, social media is not real, it's just people posting their highlights. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to see their lowlights. I want to see the best. I want to see the testimony of the goodness of what God's doing in their life. But at the same time, I need to guard my own heart and make sure that I'm not getting jealous by that or insecure or resentful or hurt because I want what they've got, but rather be inspired or motivated or learn or encourage and check my own mental health while I'm perusing.
But you can still build relationships without social media too.
Is it really possible? Like, are you making that as a claim or as a question?
Well, personally, I'm making it as a claim, but I'm throwing it to you as a question.
Well, of course that's true. But in our day and age, for young people, or even for employers, you know, if we're going to enter into a relationship, a commercial relationship, many employers go first to social media to actually see what's being posted and who are you behind the scenes, behind the facade of this interview. What are you really interested in? What do you really like? You know, what do you like in your social life? Because that character being put on display is ultimately certainly going to come into our corporate life as well. So we want to make sure that you're authentic and genuine.
Do you guys here, talking to you, both of you, two young girls here, do you understand that if employers were looking to employ you that they could easily look on? Do you ever give that any thought as you're posting things, as you're putting things, as you're putting comments on social media?
Yeah, 100%.
You do? We got smart girls here. Smart team. But I don't think everyone would.
No.
I think in the craziness of things, it's like, ha, 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 this is really funny, or doing maybe some pictures that are not so, you know, because it could lead to even situations of bullying and belittling people and, yeah. Anyway, I'm very on the fence with social media. Sometimes I think it's good and I'm using it, and then other times I'm like, oh, I just want to get right away from it. I am so sick of it. Give me a break.
You're just like my wife. My wife, she's like, I'm not sure, you know, and she's abandoned it, for wholesale for lengthy periods of time.
Yeah.
And but me, I'm still chugging along.
Okay then. So another question I have. Now, there is a myth, and you may have raised this in the dating night, of the soulmate.
Oh, yes.
Myth.
Yes.
And do you want to just share a little bit more around this soulmate myth?
People are looking for a soulmate, the one.
Yes.
And oftentimes young people ask, how do I know if they're actually the one?
That is the classic question, isn't it?
Another question is there such a thing as the one?
Yes.
Because when you look at it's scripture, like I marvel, I look at Genesis and I think, wow, things were not always the way that they are today. You know, Abraham says to his servant, go find a wife for my son, Isaac. And and so he heads on out to the place where Abraham originally came from, and some girl waters his camels, and she said, she'll do. And so brings her back, and how do we know she's the one? Well, she watered the camels. That's that. Well, Isaac had never met Rebecca. It's not like the guy came in and said, I found this hot babe called Becky, and she's the – no, she watered my camels. And so things haven't always been the way in which we have it now, that we find the one that we fall in love with, that they will complete us, like the movies say, and that we enter into the happily ever after. But rather, in ancient times, relationships started first with sacrifice and commitment, and the love often followed. The more you spend time getting to know somebody, you actually develop a common passion for the core values or for the direction in which we're heading. Mm. So soulmate can be interpreted in two different ways. Either the stereotype of what Hollywood wants us to think, you know, that there is a soulmate, you know, internal soul, or maybe it's your soulmate, as in the sole of your foot, that it's somebody that you can walk this journey together with, heading out in the same direction, the same call on your life, and not necessarily the same interests, because that's not what makes for compatibility, but the same core values. In fact, research even shows that when people embark upon a project together as romantic couples, whether it be a ministry project involved in serving in the church or even a business project, their marriage is seen to improve. There's something about walking together with somebody heading out in the same direction.
Yeah.
Not just because they complete you.
Okay. I could say so much stuff right now. But can I ask you then, do you believe that Nolene, your wife, is your soulmate?
I think that she is the person that I am meant to be with in terms of I believe that God set up an opportunity for us to meet, but it's not like I had to marry her. Yeah. I think that God presented us with an opportunity that we could get to make our own free will decision. Because I remember seeing Nolene for the very first time. It was like a shampoo ad. She was walking across the courtyard in slow motion. The sun was shining in the right direction. She turned around as though there's this spray of hair. And I just thought to myself, yeah, baby, like, I rocked my world. And it took me 3 months to work up the courage to actually introduce myself to her because I was so smitten. But it's not because I was smitten that makes for the relationship that
That's
we
right.
have today.
Yeah.
It's because we got to dig deeper and find out what makes each other tick.
Yeah.
What's on the inside, and is that compatible with where I'm going in life?
Mm-hmm.
And I love that we get to walk this journey together.
Yeah.
And we're opposite. We're opposites attract. We don't have to have things in common, but we have a similar passion for the world in which we serve.
Yeah. For me personally, I think Gary and I would be a little bit similar. I think I could have married a number of people, and I'm not saying that to like big up me at all. But
yes,
I personally think, I don't think that Gary Clark was just the person, and he was sitting there on the shelf just waiting for me. And then we just collided, and then this was meant to be, and there was nobody else.
So good.
But once we made that decision and that choice to go, yep, we want to do life together, then he became my soulmate.
Well, that answers the question, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When people ask, you know, who's the one? Well, the one you marry, that's the one. How do you know if they're
yes.
the one? Well, you married them, so
yes.
stick with that
yes.
one. Engage commitment, because
yeah.
You know, you can form an attachment to almost anything that you spend time investing in.
Yeah, that's so true. All right, one of your points has been to look for people with the same calling. What do you mean by that? Calling is a kind of a funny word. It's a bit of a Christian word, isn't it?
Or, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not necessarily the same calling, because we can have a specific call on our lives to, you know, be involved in, you know, social justice or to be involved in ministry. But it's somebody who can see their lives heading in that same trajectory as a compatible partner along the journey. So I stand on stage and I preach around the world. My wife couldn't think of anything worse than you know.
I think that's why Nolene and I like each other so much. Yeah.
But yet she's a clinical psychologist yes. as well, and she does stand on stage and we'll often do relationship stuff together.
Yeah.
And so she is supporting me in this ministry, and she sees the value and the benefit of the lives that we're touching. And so because she can see and has a passion for people, well, she doesn't have to have the passion for public speaking.
Mm.
And so it's more of a compatibility than having the same call in terms of the outworking of what you end up doing in a day-to-day basis. But in the background, she's passionate about helping people as well, but
mm.
she'll do it in a different way, in her own way. And because of the compatibility and passion of helping people, we work really well together.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people could, like when you initially get married, you may initially have that similar sort of compatibility, but then someone may go off on a tangent and, you know, where does that come from? You're not quite sure.
Yeah.
You know, what happens then? How do you explain that?
Well, you got to nurture it every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that don't just happen out of left field. They can creep up on you if you haven't been paying attention, and then all of a sudden somebody goes off on a tangent. But you should be acutely aware of how people are moving, or how we're both moving, because a marriage is a dance. And mm. so it's one foot forward, one mm. foot back, one foot to the side. Doesn't matter if we're doing the cha-cha or the salsa or the waltz. You know, we're dancing together. And unless one person has stopped dancing and the other has kept dancing, and then something might come out of left field. But it shouldn't happen like that.
Mm.
Even if you did start out with similar things, similar interests, and, you know, one person develops a new interest and a new passion, it doesn't necessarily mean that the other party must now also have a passion for that thing, because otherwise we don't have anything in common anymore and we've lost the spark. It's the commitment to one another. Last night I was sharing a story about a good friend of mine, Pastor Howe, in Singapore, and his wife was a former a sports journalist, and so she loves sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to accompany her to all these sporting matches, especially baseball. And once I asked him, you must love baseball. And he's like, no. In other words, I hate baseball, but I love my wife.
Yeah.
And as a result of yeah. that, I'm going to go with her on the journey to watch
yeah.
baseball, because I see the delight that she gets out of it. I don't have to share that same passion for baseball, but we have a commitment to one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a deeper commitment. That's a deeper passion.
Yes. I'll just throw something in personally for myself right there. I'm just thinking that one thing that I had always decided that I just wanted, you do have to work out what your core values are. And one of my core values when I got married, that I really, to the best of my ability, wanted to stay married for as long as we both shall live.
Good on you.
And so sometimes I have to come back to that, because there's moments
yeah.
where you just think, oh, this is really frustrating. But then you think, you come back to the core value. What is more important? and my core value is that I want to stay married, and I want to stay married as well as everyone's safe and healthy. It's not in a risky, dangerous situation, but I want to stay married as long as we both shall live. So that core value thing is something that I think is something that's we've got to have deep inside us.
You're onto something, Kathy, because people listening to this might be thinking, what do you mean core value? I mean, it sounds like a sexy term that, you know, you'd be cool to post on an Instagram, you know, profile, but really core value? How many people actually walk into a marriage with their own core values, or how many people go through life and are able to identify? How many people could you go up to the street and say, what are your core values? And for them to go, honor, generosity, gratitude, attitude, you know, how many people could actually say off the top of their tongue because they know it, they live it, they breathe it, as opposed to, being nice to people. No, that's not your core value. You're just searching now for a nice platitude to say. I think that your statement, I walked into my marriage with core values, and one of my core values was loyalty, faithfulness, commitment. I am going to stick this marriage out to its end, and I'm going to finish the race strong. That is such a great thing for people to embrace today and figure out what are your core values. Because if you can walk into a relationship knowing who you are and what makes you tick, then you can see whether or not that's compatible with the person that you're walking into a relationship with.
Because people can look at you and think, oh, your marriage is great and your relationship is great. But no, we're just like everybody else, just like all other marriages. There's times that are good, there's times that are tough, the times that are not so good, and the times where you've got to, like, get it sorted out. But I will be absolutely honest with you and say that is one thing that I always come back to is, like, well, what would I – that is the one thing I want to do is to make sure. So what is more important to me?
It grounds you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Core values bring you back to the
anchor,
core.
Anchors you back
That's
to
it. That's it.
Yeah, those vows that you did make once. Not to shame anyone that may have, you know, for whatever reasons, because there's lots of reasons and there's lots of dynamics within marriage.
Yeah.
And that people divorce and separate and all that sort of stuff. I'm aware of that. But I'm just thinking of young people, relationships, stepping into marriage, that sort of thing, that they really do need to go into that.
Yeah, and if people have core values, and even if they don't have the same core value that you have, that I'm going to stay committed to this relationship no matter what, come hell or high water, thick or thin, or, you know, as we say in the marriage vows, for better or for worse, you know. having core values in the first place will in essence set you up for protection. It's like an inoculation, because if your core value is, for example, generosity or honor, you know, even if it wasn't faithfulness and loyalty, but generosity and honor, well, when you're struggling in that relationship and they don't, you know, that you've been hurt and hard done by, and you come back to the core, hang on, generosity, I'm going to honor this person through the extension of grace and forgiveness, because it's my core value. And that will see you through a whole manner of strife. I love that you mentioned core values. That's so valuable.
So when it comes to marriage, and having a core value of thinking, no, well, I'm in this to the end. Do you do that and do it miserable, or is it possible to do that and do it well?
I don't know that there's a one size answer fits all.
Yeah, exactly.
But I am inspired by certain authors or presenters, like Zig Ziglar. He's famous for saying once that if my wife ever leaves me, I'm going with her. So in other words, I am committed all of the way. And then you've got other people like William Wilberforce, who was out there championing great causes for social justice, yet his marriage at the same time was really hard work. And some of the biographies that have been written, you know, kind of indicate that his wife was not easy to live with. And yet he maintained his faithfulness and dedication to her, despite her being such a difficult person. And so, you know, we can take inspiration from these individuals. But then if you're in a relationship where, that person really is impossible, they're abusive, they're, you know, it's, well, God hates divorce, and, you know, but he hates you getting punched in the face as well. You know, if you're in harm's way, get out of harm's way. So I think one of the secrets here is find the right person. finding the person who you can see that you can indeed live a lifetime must not be clouded by hormones. So in other words, if you're already engaging in sexual activity, well, you can't trust a hormone-driven decision. You have to make a decision that is based on logic and rational thinking, not just passion and emotions.
So if you're dating and you are then going further and getting involved in sexual activity, that really could be clouding clear thinking and decision-making for the long term.
Exactly. Yeah. And so getting married is...
So it's like stay away from it.
Yes.
Don't play around.
And staying married, half of staying married is marrying the right person to begin with.
Yeah.
And if you're playing around, you'll be clouded and confused, and your judgment will be impaired as to making that wise decision. So wisdom right from the outset.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, life, it just continues, doesn't it? As in, it's always going to be choices, always going to be decisions, all the way along. It's never ever going to be like, well, we've made it now. We've got it all worked out. We're all happy. We're all sweet. We're in that sweet spot.
Yeah.
Nah. It's not going to stay like that.
No, there's no destination.
It's up and down and up and down and up and down and constantly changing. So if it is that, well, I'm being a bit miserable, then it's like, guess what? You can change. Or you can look at somebody else's marriage and you go, well, I don't want to end up like that. You know, they decided to stay married. Yeah, they did, but they were miserable.
Yes.
Well, that doesn't mean that has to be the same way for you.
That's really great, Kathy. And I don't know that anyone really says these kind of things anymore, because if I'm in a miserable marriage, I just point the finger and I blame. And so if you are finding yourself in a position of blame, here's the first thing to do. Go walk into the bathroom, look in the mirror and ask yourself, and what could I have done better? I'm in this situation right now. What could I have done better, or what can I do better right now so as to change the situation? I don't have to stay in a miserable marriage, because most people go, well, I don't want to be miserable, and so it's better off that we, you know, end up separating and going our separate ways. Well, yes, that's one option available to you. Here's another. Instead of trialing a separation, why don't you trial a marriage? Why don't you actually go in there and ask yourself the question, what would make this marriage actually better? What can I do? Yeah. I might not be able to change this other person, but there are definitely things that I can do to bring about spontaneity, laughter, affection, interest. What can we do to resuscitate this marriage back to life?
Yep. I couldn't agree more. It's possible. It's doable.
It's definitely doable. Mm. We do it every day in the psychology clinic.
Yeah.
If you're willing.
Cool. All right, then. Let's just jump on then. Why do you think, or do you think this is the case, that there's a hesitancy towards long-term commitments? We've just been talking about core values, but then I'm thinking too, I'm 57 now, so I'm a little bit older. But for younger people, is there a hesitancy to long-term commitment?
Look, I don't want to speak for all young people, but it goes without saying that a part and parcel of human nature is we don't want to make the wrong decision. And if I have a faith and I see, you know, I read in scripture that God hates divorce and, you know, we make these vows before God until death do us part. Well, I don't want to be stuck with the wrong person for the rest of my life. And so I'm a little bit wary walking into a relationship. Mm. But there's a whole other dynamic that adds to that anxiety. And that is we're living in a fast food throwaway society that if you're, you know, if your iPhone breaks, just upgrade your model. And so we're always thinking replacement. And if anything is defective, well, throw it out. We're in a throwaway society. It's cheaper to replace it than it is to fix it. Mm. And so when we take that attitude into relationships as well, that didn't work, or he offended me, and so I'm going to throw away that relationship. I'll start again. Well, you can only do that so often until you realize, oh, there's a common denominator in all of the relationships that you've burned through, and that's you were always there. You were always a part of those relationships. And so it takes great hard work and effort and commitment and sacrifice to actually work on ourselves and have the courage to actually commit, because that's in essence what Jesus did. Like he started with a commitment, a sacrifice. He paid the ultimate price and then invited us to be in relationship with him, giving us the free will to say no, but still had to pay the price.
Yeah.
He's the ultimate example of commitment in relationship.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know that we're time starting to tick down, so I just wanted to jump in because this is kind of like a hot, sort of interesting question. That
should I be nervous? This what, is getting juicy now?
Yeah, no, this is right down your alley, mate. What impact is pornography use having on people? I'll just leave it there, but then, you know, we've got people in the church, but just generally what, because you've done quite a bit of study on pornography, haven't you,
and projecting
into the future what you think the damage could be.
There are lots of studies and surveys out now, so it's not so alarming or controversial to state these things anymore. Information is quite common knowledge that, look, in general society, 10% of the population acknowledge to having a problem with pornography. And when we say problem, it's not that I've watched it. No, that would be 99% of the population, but rather I can't stop watching it. And so if we were to look at that as a formal addiction, not that it's necessarily classified that way in the DSM just yet, well, that would be by far the greatest addiction known to mankind if we were to stack 10% up against, say, alcoholism or gambling or other types of habitual patterns of behavior. But when it comes to surveys of people in the church, that statistic of 10% jumps to a great big whopping 49%.
Wow.
And so 49% of people surveyed recognize that they have a problem with pornography. And that's something that we don't really talk about in the church.
What are we doing wrong?
Well, chances are the reason why we don't talk about it is because when we look at church leaders, the statistic jumps to 67%.
Oh,
so
you're kidding me.
A survey done by Focus on the Family asked, ministry leaders who were coming for a conference, you know, how many of you would have consumed pornography in the last week? Anonymous survey in 67%. 67% said, well, yeah, that's me. And we know this to be true from church conferences that take place. The pornography use in hotels just skyrockets and goes through the roof. And so, and why is it that people are struggling with this in the church?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you're a non-believer, you'd be thinking to yourself, I knew it, those sicko, wacko Christian people, the priests always getting busted as pedophiles and all the rest of it. But hang on, let's just unpack this for a second. We've got this thing in our faith called conscience. That we know this is not right. And therefore, when we engage in the thing that we don't really want to do and we know is wrong, because God talks openly and clearly and dogmatically about sexual purity, and when we are not pure, when we're splattered and we put our hands up and we go, yeah, I actively engage this, well, then we beat ourselves up. And guilt and shame is a precursor for relapse. So in simple language, if you beat yourself up for what you've done, you're almost certainly insured to do it again. And so in the old school, you know, religious mindset, you know, beating yourself up is a good thing, you know, pricks your conscience to make you want to do the right thing. And no, the devil is the accuser. That's why I love God. He just says, my grace is renewed in a fresh view every morning. So long as you don't develop this attitude of entitlement or of justification and, well, what's a big deal and I can do this and I should have the right to do whatever I want and, you know, if God made me this way and, you know, well, you know, good luck to you if that's your attitude because, you know, pride comes before a fall and God resists the proud. But if we maintain our humility and say, no, I am willing to do whatever it takes to pursue purity, because if I don't, the stats are pretty mean, not lean. The United States Matrimonial Institute of Law came out saying that, you know, well, divorces these days, the landscape has changed. 50% of divorces have something to do with the internet. Now, we could say, well, that's working too much or surfing the internet too much. And then they clarify and say, no, actually 50% of that is directly attributable to internet pornography. So when it comes to the impact of pornography on marriage, it's absolutely detrimental. We need to get to the bottom of this and start speaking about it more prolifically.
Yeah.
It's optimistic.
Always, I know. It's always that one of those things that's there's always the two sides, isn't there? You know, internet is phenomenal. We couldn't do life without the internet.
Yeah.
The strength that it gives you, but at the same time, it's got such a downside to it as well.
Yeah, but that's true with everything. It's true.
Yeah,
with,
that's right.
It's true with guns. It's true with cars.
It's
true with
social media. It is. It's true with everything. Yes, so that's where core values.
Core values.
You've got to bring your core values. God values.
And that's private self-consciousness. It comes full circle now. Yeah. We were talking about public and private self-consciousness. Yeah. This is who I am. This is what I stand for. This is what I believe in. And core values are like superhero powers.
Yeah.
You know, the superhero power that Superman has isn't that he can jump over a building in a single bound and, you know, race off and save an emergency. It's when he's watching, you know, Tottenham play Chelsea and it's the final minute of the match. And then with his supersonic hearing, he can hear that a girl is falling off a bridge somewhere. What does he do in that moment? His core value, his real superhero power is to sacrifice and forsake himself and go save the girl, even though he'll miss out on the winning goal or the final minute of the match. That's our superhero power, core values.
Very good. All right, Robbie, I have one more question for you. You seem to have so much knowledge. You have a lot of knowledge. You obviously study, you read, you're always learning. What are you reading at the moment? Or what is this? Is there something that you would really advise other people would be great book to read? Because this is this kind of psychological stuff. People are interested in it, whether it's related to just personal life with your own finances or your work or your relationships. People just genuinely find it very interesting.
Yeah.
What are they reading? What are you reading?
I am a perpetual learner.
Yeah.
I'm learning every day and I'll go through a number of books or educational learning platforms, you know, every week. And but I'm not necessarily reading. And so, you know, you might have heard the statement, leaders are readers. I disagree because the Bible I read says faith comes by hearing. That's my excuse anyway. So readers are not necessarily leaders. Leaders are not necessarily readers, but leaders are learners.
Yeah.
And so the way in which I learn is through podcast or audiobook. And so I don't have that much time to sit down and read, but I will consume books on audio because I can listen to it and actually tap double the speed and go through books, you know, faster or on Blinkist, actually get a 15-minute summary of books, or I'll be listening to lectures and seminars. And so every day when I work out or when I drive to work, my car and my gym are my university. I'm a perpetual student. But of course, there is one book that I do read, and you ask, what am I reading? And that's the Bible. And I just, you know, I think that we can get carried away with the latest, greatest, you know, hoo-ha of this person's book or this person's book. But I just keep coming back to the book that I am perpetually reading. And I love getting direct input from the master professor. Mm-hmm. And
so you don't always just go with audio for your Bible. You actually have paper.
Paper. Or if I'm traveling, I've got my electronic devices, and even if I've got a busy day, I've got my Bible app that can speak to me as I'm driving to work, and I want to get my daily inputs, like filling up petrol in the car. Takes me places.
I remember asking you something similar quite a few years ago, and you said you'll often follow Psychology Today.
Yes.
Is that on? Well, that would be Instagram, Twitter, whatever, and that they often have really interesting articles.
Yeah, so I follow Psychology News or Psych News and Psychology in Life, which has a handle of Psychology Life, or even Psychology Today or Psych Today and Psychologypedia. So Twitter's become my news source, and I love that they just post the highlight titles of articles. So rather than wading through a book or reams of journals, if the title jumps out and grabs me, I can click and I can read more. And it's a fast and efficient way of gaining access to information in an information age where we're just bombarded with so much information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any books that you are actually...
Well, I'm actually
audio listening to.
I've got a little bit of a pet theme at the moment, and that is the role that the gut plays in mental health.
Oh.
And so I am devouring books almost like at lightning speed now, looking at what scientists are referring to as the second brain, that we've got more brain cells in our gut than in any other organ of the body outside the brain. And so there's an intimate role. So when you have that gut feeling or that gut sense. Well, literally, there's neurons in the gut. And the health of your gut in terms of how well your gut flora is functioning has a direct relationship with now in terms of how well you're able to think clearly and be emotionally stable. And so what we eat and our diet and everything you put in your mouth is medicine. Mm-hmm. And you're either medicating your brain up or medicating your brain down. And so I'm fascinated now that I guess the advances of neuroscience have helped us understand it's not just about psychology. Yeah. It's about psychology in relation to, and then fill in the blank, in relation to your experiences, your relationships, but also your biology, especially your metabolism, your immune system, and your gut flora. Mm-hmm. How well is your gut functioning?
Okay.
It will determine your mental health.
Is there any name of any like series at all that you could share with us?
So the books that I've just recently read include Activate Your Brain, Brain Maker, Follow Your Gut, Genius Foods, Gut, just G-U-T, High Performance Habits. These are the kind of things that are relating not just your behavioral skills, but also how can you fuel your brain? Because the reality is, if you want to go to the moon, only rocket fuel will do.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. This will be a podcast. So okay. Hopefully someone will be listening to this.
Come on, in their car, in the gym.
Yeah, that's right, or on the way to work or wherever they're going. So they'll learn something from it
I hope
as well.
So. I hope you get something out of it.
All right. Yeah. Thanks so much, Robbie.
Pleasure.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to hear from you too. Check us out on Instagram at Convos with Kathy. If you have any questions or thoughts about what we've talked about today, or even suggestions of a topic you'd like to hear about, feel free to DM us. We'd love to connect with you. Till next time, see ya.